The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Senator Tom Cotton addresses the violence plaguing our city.
An overwhelming show of force from the beginning is how to avert the use of force by anyone.
We examine new threats from Russia.
So the question you have to ask is, why? Why now?
Joe Biden steers clear of the media.
I think he should take more questions than he does. I think he should, put himself out there to any reporter, any and all reporters, and let us grill him a little bit.
And Democrats disparage America.
An entire party is devoted to the false narrative, and they do it with apparent impunity because no one called them on it.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at hughhewitt.com, and let me invite you to join us now by video. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Please follow this program as well, at Town Hall Review. The Republican National Convention was a stark contrast to that put on by the Democrats a week earlier. Joe Biden's team put on a four-day Zoom meeting, portraying a country afraid to go outside. Republicans brought people together, physically, fearless, optimistic. The sight of an actual crowd listening from the White House lawn live was the polar opposite of the screens we saw at the empty Democratic convention. But what happened after the president formally accepted the Republican nomination also told a tale to the voters. Angry crowds waited outside to harass and intimidate Republicans. I discussed this troubling event with Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton. Many people were assaulted as they moved towards their car and dispersed. I don't know if you were in that crowd that encountered demonstrators, were you?
No, Hugh, I did not attend the president's speech on the South Lawn of the White House, but I was appalled by the violence I saw in the streets of Washington. I know many people, not just public figures, who were accosted by those anarchists and insurrectionists. It's shameful that Muriel Bowser did not allow the Washington, D.C. police to do their job and protect innocent citizens on the streets of Washington. Also, I gather that the Secret Service wanted to go out and help the police as well, and Bowser had objected to that. It's the exact kind of feckless and indecisive leadership we saw from Muriel Bowser in June that allowed rioting to happen in and around the White House.
You know, the mayor of D.C. is going to be responsible for the closure of all these restaurants on the U Street corridor and in Adams Morgan and DuPont Circle, where people are just not going to go if the mob is allowed to harass and intimidate people.
I'm sure that all your listeners have seen those videos of people eating outside because of continued restrictions for indoor dining, in which these angry mobs come up and start screaming at diners and patrons for no reason whatsoever, demanding that they spout their political slogans. And usually the police are nowhere to be seen. Now, I'm confident that your rank-and-file police officer in Washington, D.C. wants to stop that kind of aggression on the streets of Washington before their city loses out, as you say, on people coming to visit for tourism or just commerce dining out. But once again, it's the hapless and feckless leadership in Washington, D.C. that is restraining the police from doing their jobs.
Now, Senator Cotton, I don't know that anyone has asked you this yet. When you look at violence in Portland or Kenosha, what do you think needs to be done to restore order in Portland?
Hugh, there has to be an overwhelming display of force. That's the way you avoid the use of force, by the authorities or the use of force by these armed anarchists and insurrectionists in the street. So, for instance, in Kenosha, it was obvious from reports on social media or in the news that there was going to be some degree of rioting. The governor of Wisconsin should have immediately mobilized the National Guard and sent them out to preempt any effort at violence. Should have simply said, We can have protesters here. We can have counter-protesters there. But there will be zero violence. There will be zero looting. There will be zero arson on the streets tonight. He only did that after three nights and more loss of life in Kenosha. And that has stopped the violence. These mayors and governors need to understand from the very beginning, if they have one of these flashpoints, an overwhelming show of force from the beginning is how to avert the use of force by anyone.
Now, President Trump told Laura Ingraham his supporters should not confront opponents. They should not go toe-to-toe with Antifa. They ought not to show up at any kind of demonstration anywhere and seek confrontation. I agree with that. Even though it's their right, I just don't see any upside in engaging with anarchists, Senator Cotton. Do you agree or disagree with the president and me?
Well, I think the president's very concerned about what he saw in Portland and what he saw just outside the White House of these radical insurrectionists and anarchists, so people who truly want to burn down our system. I mean, they chant that. They chant death to America, engaged in wanton violence against anyone. So his calls not to be confrontational in that matter, not to go out of one's way, I think are prudent under the circumstance. Now, of course, it's a different circumstance. You know, like some of those business owners in Kenosha who are trying to protect their own property, they don't really have a choice when the mob shows up. Although, of course, one would hope that mayors and governors would allow the police and, if necessary, the National Guard to protect property and innocent lives from that kind of violence.
Now, I want to switch to specific issues, Senator. Here's Joe Biden talking about fracking.
I am not banning fracking. Let me say that again. I am not banning fracking. No matter how many times Donald Trump lies about me.
Now, he is for fracking after he was against it, Senator Cotton. I've played a number of montages where he's been against fracking, new fracking, old fracking, fossil fuels. How in the world can people ignore this?
Well, Hugh, let's give Joe the benefit of the doubt, and let's not assume that he's lying. Let's just assume that he forgot when he said that he was going to ban fracking repeatedly during the Democratic primaries.
He did. I mean, he did. Okay, translate this if you can.
COVID has taken this year, just since the outbreak, has taken more than 100 years. Look, here's the lives. You think about it. More lives this year than any other year for the past 100 years.
Okay, Senator, what's that mean?
Well, Hugh, that wasn't the smoothest delivery off a pre-written speech on a teleprompter, but I'm not sure I can translate it for you.
All right. Then he asked the rhetorical question, cut number one.
Ask yourself, do I look like a radical socialist with a soft spot for rioters? Really?
My answer is yes, because on one side you've got Kamala Harris, and on the other side you've got AOC. But what do you say, Senator?
Well, he looks like an empty suit that for 50 years has gone along with whatever fad and fashion is ascendant in the Democratic Party. And now the fad and fashion is to coddle these rioters and these anarchists in the streets because it's part of their base. Don't look at what they say in the heat of the moment of the campaign when they know that they're in trouble. Look at what they've done.
With all eyes on domestic turmoil and a highly contentious election in mid-stride, many have missed a troubling story on Russian aggression towards the United States and its allies. I asked retired United States Navy Admiral James Stavridis about one particularly dangerous incident. I began with an article out of the Wall Street Journal. I read from the Nancy Youssef article. Russian pilots harassed a U.S. B-52 bomber flying over the Black Sea in an international waters, crossing within 100 feet of the bomber's path, a maneuver the U.S. military called unsafe and unprofessional. The confrontation was the second between U.S. and Russian military forces in a week. What do you make of this, Admiral?
Russia is out and about in the world and pushing hard against us in a lot of different places. Let me add a third little notice, but I think significant event, which is Russian naval and aviation military exercises off the coast of Alaska, due to include 50 Russian warships just off the coast of Alaska. So we see Vladimir Putin continuing to push in the Middle East, where he's trying to gain influence and affect outcomes as the Syrian war staggers to a conclusion. He's going to continue pressing around the borders of the NATO alliance in Europe, as with these, I would say, not just unprofessional, really outrageous close air maneuvers around our B-52s and naval aviation around the very borders, maritime borders of the United States. So the question you have to ask is, why? Why now? And I think there's an internal component and an external component. Internally, as you know, Hugh, his numbers are down. He has felt the need to poison the leading political opposition member, Navalny, who's now in Germany attempting to recover. He's got internal problems. So this makes him look big, large, and in charge, acting against the United States. And then that's the internal piece. And then externally, each of these have a little different aspect to them, but overall it's Putin wanting to drive a wedge between the United States and our NATO allies. That's his big objective here. That's why the B-52 incident you mentioned is the most important.
Now, I was unaware that we routinely flew B-52 over all 30 NATO countries. And
we do not. We do not. That is not routine. This was designed to demonstrate the capability to do it, and it also is part of celebrating the addition of the final 30th member, Montenegro and Macedonia, just joining.
Now, I'm curious, Admiral, your successor in interest, whoever is the Allied Supreme Commander of NATO right now, I don't know who that is.
General Todd Walters.
Okay, so Todd Walters is sitting at his NATO desk, which I assume is a nice desk with a bunch of flags, and the phone rings, and he says, we got, do they call him up? Do they let him know they're a Russian fighter dogging our B-52s?
Oh, absolutely. By the way, before we get off the subject, the desk that the Supreme Allied Commander sits behind was Eisenhower's desk.
Okay,
was the
cool
Supreme
desk.
Allied Commander. It is a very cool desk, yes. But the phone rings, absolutely. And then General Walters, I'm sure, proceeds immediately to the NATO operational center, just like the one we have in the Pentagon. And he'll go down there and he'll be watching screens and looking at the whole thing and making decisions. But let's face it, an incident like this is happening in real time. So he's not going to have the opportunity to respond. What he will do is put the alliance's air defense systems on alert. He's going to be notifying his NATO bosses, going to the Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, up in Brussels. He's going to be communicating up his U.S. chain of command to the Secretary of Defense, Dr. Mark Esper, and he is probably going to scramble some NATO fighters in case this thing goes really sideways. So he's a busy guy at a moment like this when Russian jets are interfering in such a dramatic fashion with a very peaceful mission of alliance solidarity.
Coming up. Mainstream media would like to talk to Joe Biden.
I think he should take more questions than he does. I think he should, you know, I think he should put himself out there to any reporter, any and all reporters, and let us grill him a little bit.
Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Joe Biden has avoided all but the friendliest media. Even when he finally decided to do a press conference in the middle of the week, he called reporters from a pre-approved list. The questions were simple. The answer is quite easy. He's yet to do a real press conference, the kind President Trump has endured for years, indeed seems to enjoy and does a couple of times a day. When Trump stops to talk to the reporters, hostile questions come from every corner of the room, every inch of the line. At this point, Joe Biden, by contrast, is a carefully coddled candidate. I discussed this issue with Michael Shear, White House correspondent for The New York Times. How long until Joe Biden has to actually hold a press conference?
You know, as a reporter, I absolutely am always hoping and pushing and advocating for presidents to take as many questions as they possibly can. I got frustrated when Barack Obama held relatively few press conferences, did not engage with reporters as much as I wanted during the 8 years that I covered him. I think President Trump has gone the other direction. He takes questions constantly from reporters to the point that sometimes I think his advisors must think that he does it too much. And Joe Biden, I think, you know, I mean, I would encourage him. I would, you know, as an advocate of the Fourth Estate and the importance of, you know, holding our leaders accountable, I think he should. I think he should take more questions than he does. I think he should, you know, I think he should put himself out there to any reporter, any and all reporters, and let us grill him a little bit.
At what point does the public, do you think, begin to notice that Joe Biden doesn't talk to anybody and the president talks to everyone?
I mean, that's a good question. I don't know. I you know, as a reporter, sometimes I feel like I'm you know, screaming into the vacuum, you know, trying to get the public to take the side of reporters in demanding that politicians, you know, kind of put themselves out there. In the past, I haven't felt like the public really cares that much. But you're right. I mean, at some point, it's going to become noticeable, and maybe people will, maybe people will hold Joe Biden to account and will think that he's, you know, avoiding trying to answer the tough question.
Let me do a quick polling temperature on you. The Emerson poll came out and showed it down to a 2-point race, which is a big swing, and that's an outlier at this point. But the morning consult just makes me crazy. It's got Trump up 5 in Ohio and down 10 in Michigan. Now, I know Ohio and Michigan, having gone to law school in the state up north and having grown up in Ohio. They're not 15 points apart. I mean, they're just not. What do you put that down to?
I don't know. I mean, look, I think if I'm not mistaken, and correct me if I am, but I think it's also only got Trump up by 1 in Texas.
Yes.
Which also seems, just from kind of what, sort of what we know logically, that seems like that would understate Trump's performance in Texas. So I don't know. I mean, as you said about the other poll, too, like any single poll can be, can be an outlier, or can be off. One of the averages of all of these polls still has Biden up nationally by like 6 or 7, kind of leading in some of these battleground states. And I think that's the better way to look at polling is not at any single poll, but to say sort of what direction do things seem to be trending in. And it seems like, you know, in the key important states, it's getting closer. It's tightening, as you would expect, as people pay attention. But that it does seem like the president is at least struggling, in some of the places that he both won in 2016 and has to win in 2020.
As sports tries to find ways to help players and fans deal with racial tension, the NBA is teetering dangerously close to a radical edge. And it appears a lot of fans are not playing along, as ratings for the games are down significantly. Peter Kirsten now is in his third term as a member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. He examined the conflict many fans have with NBA players while on with Bob Franz on AM 1420, The Answer in Cleveland.
I'm ready to join the walkaway campaign. In fact, I have joined it when it comes to professional sports.
I've walked away. I'm not involved in any of the craziness that's going on. Only in America could a millionaire maintain that he is somehow oppressed. This is not to discount that, you know, there are imperfections in society, there are certain injustices, but almost everything that we've heard from the major league franchises, from the various players, all these woke commissioners, is based on a complete and utter falsehood, and that should matter. And what's incredible to me, and probably to all of your listeners, well, maybe less incredible now than it would have been, say, 15, 20 years ago, is that the falsehoods are there for everyone to see. They are blatant. They are not a mystery whatsoever, yet the falsehoods remain as if they are fact. The media does nothing to dispel them. Academia does nothing to dispel them. In fact, they try to build upon them and exacerbate them, as with the 1619 Project and other things similar to that. And it's an entire party is devoted to the false narrative. I've never in my lifetime seen this kind of blanket prevarication on the part of major institutions. And they do it with apparent impunity because no one, with the exception of maybe a Donald Trump and, you know, conservative media outlets such as yours, call them on it. It's truly an extraordinary place we are in society today.
The NFL is about to dive headfirst into the same mess that the NBA is in. They're going to allow players to put the names of what they believe to be victims of unjust police brutality or shootings or whatever on the back of their helmets. Remember, they would not allow the Dallas Cowboys to put a mm-hmm. symbol on the back of their helmet to represent five police officers who were murdered in an ambush a few years ago. But I want to dive into this since we, like I said, since we kind of got taken into it by your normal countdown. But LeBron James, during this period of grandstanding, declared, and I quote, "We are scared as black people in America. Black men, black women, black kids, we are terrified." Pete, Larry Elder fact-checked him. On Twitter, reminding him that cops kill two times as many whites as they do blacks, and at least as many unarmed whites as unarmed blacks, and that half of homicide victims in the U.S. are black, almost all killed by blacks, and that the number one cause of preventable death for white males is accidents. The number one cause of death for black males is homicide by other blacks. But most people aren't seeing what Larry Elder fact-checked him on. You know, LeBron James has 40, 50 million followers on Twitter. LeBron James has an enormous platform, and he is trying to sell that the reason they boycotted and the reason they, delayed or postponed games, et cetera, is because black people in this country are being hunted. Peter, you've done the stats, and I certainly know you've read them. When it comes to interracial crimes in America, that means violent crimes committed by one race against another. There is only one race that should feel hunted in this country, and it is not LeBron James' race or your race.
Right. Yeah, that's correct. In terms of interracial crimes, it is extraordinary the imbalance. In terms of violent crime committed by blacks against whites versus the reverse, the overwhelming majority of interracial crimes, violent crimes, are committed by blacks against other races, principally whites. A infinitesimally small percentage of interracial crimes are whites against blacks.
To hear the entire interview, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up,
LeBron James has been promoting this racial tension.
Larry Elder with his look at the NBA when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. As noted earlier, the NBA has reacted to the racial tensions rather strongly, canceling games followed by players nearly voting to cancel the remainder of the season. Trouble is, most of the sports media, like nearly all of the news media, leans left, so there have been few voices of reason. But Salem host Larry Elder did find one.
The NBA canceled games, and Doc Rivers tearfully gave a press conference in which he said,
"All you hear is Donald Trump and all of them talking about fear. We're the ones getting killed. We're the ones getting shot. We're the ones that we're denied to live in certain communities. We've been hung. We've been shot. And all you do is keep hearing about fear. It's amazing to me why we keep loving this country, and this country does not love us back."
Sigh. Now, like LeBron James, the LA Clippers coach Doc Rivers has a great deal of clout in the NBA, largely because of the way he handled the situation with the former owner Donald Sterling, who's on tape making all sorts of bigoted comments about his players. He also has enormous responsibility to be factual. And as I've been saying, these athletes, that live and die about stats. They can tell you about their stats. They can tell you about their free throw percentage, their three-point line percentage, how many shots they take, how many minutes they play. And when their agent is trying to negotiate a new contract or a higher contract, of course the agent comes armed with all sorts of stats in order to make their case. My point is these guys cannot function without facts, without data, without logic. But when it comes to the assertion that the police are out killing black people just because they're black, why aren't you demanding facts? Why aren't you demanding data? Why aren't you demanding evidence, proof to corroborate the assertion? They don't. All they do is parrot lines other people make. LeBron James, after Ahmaud Arbery was killed, we're afraid to leave our homes. Doc Rivers, we're the ones getting shot. We're the ones getting hanged. Do you know how infrequently this happens, that a unarmed black person is killed by a white cop? Of the 1,000 average police killings in the last several years, again, 500 of them have been white, 250 of them have been black. At least as many, if not more, unarmed whites have been killed compared to unarmed blacks. Knock it off. The data are not there. And according to the CDC, the percentage at which cops kill blacks has declined 75% in the last 50, 60 years. Where's your evidence? Where's your proof? If I were some sort of scout and I said, I've got a great basketball player, why don't you sign him? You'd say, excuse me? Can you tell me about him? Give me his numbers. Who'd he play with? Quality of his competition, yada, blah, etc. But when it comes to this, Jason Whitlock is a sportscaster. He is with an organization called Outkick.com. Happens to be black. Here's what he said about LeBron James's assertion that these kinds of police killings occur all the time and black people are under siege and should be living in fear.
I wrote something about LeBron James that needs further explanation. I called LeBron James a bigot. I wrote a column this week, headline, Whitlock, LeBron James is a bigot. I did that because of the way LeBron James has reacted in this moment of civil unrest, racial tension throughout America. LeBron James has been promoting this racial tension. Why? Is this proper leadership? Is this a mature response to the problems we're having here in America? In Kenosha, Wisconsin, as all of you all know, the police shot Jacob Blake 7 times in the back as he resisted arrest and tried to get into his car. We don't have enough facts about this case for anybody to be rendering some kind of strong, over-the-top opinion about who's right or who's wrong. There's time to figure that out. But LeBron James, and the way our system is set up now, and the way social media has put these athletes and other celebrities on a pedestal and given them an outsized voice in the media space. LeBron James has more than 40 million Twitter followers, probably got another 30, 40 million followers on Instagram. He has a bigger platform right now to speak to America than any individual person in the media. A basketball player, a 6'9" basketball player who did not attend college.
These athletes are parroting the line that the police are killing black people just because they're black. LeBron James, we're afraid to leave our house. Doc Rivers, I don't understand America. America doesn't love us back. We keep loving America and they don't love us back. What does that even mean?
Coming up, the lockdown in California wipes out a beloved chef.
I'm done. I'm finished.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Many states opened months ago, an effort to keep businesses afloat and give workers a way to make a living. But the state of California remains largely locked down, suffocating even those businesses who had margin when this all began. Dennis Prager looks at one example that is a perfect representation of so many more. Richard Florzak has been known as the chef to Hollywood stars for more than 2 decades. But even he can't survive what the state has done. He was on the Dennis Prager show.
So, Richard Florzak, let's get the story here. You were allowed to open, correct, for like 2 weeks?
I don't think it was quite 2 weeks, but just about 2 weeks.
Did people come in?
Barely.
Because they're afraid?
I think because they don't know. You know, there's two different situations here. You've got the rules of the restaurant that we get sent information via email or some inspector stops by. But customers don't know the rules. So just because they change the rules one day and say you can be open at 65% capacity, that the customers aren't notified of that. So they've been used to a complete shutdown where they can only order to go or deliver.
Oh, so a lot of people didn't even know restaurants were open for indoor dining.
The amount of time that I was open, be it 2 weeks or whatever, by the end of that second week, people would come in to pick up their food and say, oh, you have outdoor, you're open again?
Why is there no uprising by restaurant owners, nail salon owners, hair salon owners, and just about any retailer in California? Do you have an idea why?
Yeah, because they're afraid. They're afraid. The government has so much power. I get a health inspection. It's supposed to be once a year. I fear them coming in for months before that, because if I cross them in any way, I learned very early on with the health inspectors, do not ask them about the logic of any specific rule, because they look right through you and they've got this look on their face that says to me, keep it up and I'll shut you down. So that's why, in my opinion, that's why business owners are afraid to speak up.
Because they could lose their license.
Yes. But you see what happens with the hair salon in Texas. The woman wanted to stay open.
It
became national news.
She did become national news. Is there communication among restaurant owners? Do you have like an association?
There is a restaurant association, but I think for individual owners, we just work such long hours. We don't have time to socialize or to even, deal with other business owners.
Will you remain in business?
Good question. Here's the answer. I'm done. I'm done. I'm finished. I have the restaurant up for sale.
Oh my God, I didn't know this.
We're about to put our home on the market. Actually, it's a good ending, to tell you the truth. We've put our house on the market. My wife and I have zeroed in on this tiny little fishing village called Merle's Inlet in South Carolina. We're headed there the end of September to look at some homes. And we're hoping to pull up stakes and live there, conservative state.
Wow.
Yeah, that's it.
That's if you could book a U-Haul. You may have to reserve one 2 months in advance.
Right.
So many are leaving California.
Yeah.
I could cry. I know you so many years. I did not know this. Wow.
Yeah.
Are you going to start something there?
Frankly, if somebody wants to back me in a restaurant or offer me a private chef job, we're on our way. You know, but it was the COVID. You know what? I have to stop for a second, and I have to preface what I'm talking about by saying that I am very, very grateful that I own a business that was allowed to stay open. Because there's thousands, as you know, hundreds of thousands that have closed because they weren't able to stay open at all during the virus. But that being said, it was the virus that was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Well, it was the lockdown. I always correct people on that.
You're right. It was the lockdown. When they try to explain it on the news that, you know, restaurants can stay open, but just do to-go orders.
Take out, yeah.
It makes it sound so easy.
Of course.
Prior to the lockdown, my takeout business was less than 5% of my sales.
Right.
So I had to switch over. We had to retool the entire restaurant to make that work in the matter of a couple of days. I mean, it's like telling a car company, tomorrow all of your cars have to be convertibles. You know how difficult that would be? It's sort of the same situation with the restaurant. And then when they allowed us to open at 60% for 2 weeks, we had to retool it back the other way to adjust for how many do we guess we're going to get as far as to-go orders in relation to dine-in. And very few people dined in. So we had to make those calculations based on no information that we've ever had in the past on something like this.
I was in Illinois 2 weeks ago. Democratic governor, Democratic state, Democratic city, Chicago. I ate indoors in restaurants. California is close to unique in how irrational and draconian its rules are. Are you aware of that?
Yes, it's hard for me as a business owner to keep up with all of the different minute changes. I was telling you before that once a year we have a health inspection.
Which you don't know when will happen.
No, I have an idea, and of course I try to keep my restaurant as clean as possible. But just to give you an example, in the last 2 months, the inspector has been in three times.
Why?
To check that we're keeping up with the standards, and also to deliver the new rules and regulation for that given what turns out to be week. He's been there three times in 2 months.
You have outdoor dining at the restaurant.
Yes.
But that does not, I assume, make up for the loss of indoor dining.
Not even close, no.
Because the number of people coming, or just the space to even accommodate the number?
The number of people coming, yeah.
And why is that? They just don't want to eat out in the heat?
I really don't think that people know. I mean, if it's this difficult for me as the business owner to know what the rules and regulations are, how does the general public know that any specific restaurant has outdoor dining?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So who's going to buy your restaurant?
I don't know. It's like I said, it is up for sale.
Coming up.
I'm seeing chants in the news from these kids yelling, believe it or not, death to America.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook. And in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, all of a sudden, Joe Biden is against the violent protest.
It does not pass any type of a smell test if you want to dismiss 100,000 crimes committed by your supporters.
Black leaders in the church are exposing the organization Black Lives Matter.
The organization is anti-family.
We'll look at the abortion agenda of today's Democratic Party.
The signal sent in recent days is truly important and ominous.
And the victims of today's Chinese Communist Party.
There are people in America who've escaped from China, whose families have been threatened in China and have since disappeared into these concentration camps.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. It's difficult now to fathom, but when protests began, Americans were united. We were appalled by the murder of George Floyd. But the protests gave way to looting and rioting. In some cities, months later, it continues. As time goes by, we can see these are not the protesters of day one. But many are, in fact, agitators and professional ones, taking advantage of chaos and strife. Seth Leibson, Salem host on 960 The Patriot out of Phoenix, Arizona, discussed the heart of the violence with Pete Peterson, dean of the Graduate School of Public Policy at Pepperdine University.
I like your phrase against the grain, because you think of what's granular about America and what you think about throughout our whole history as a country is it is that story of our great capacity for self-renewal. That is the story of America, of course, the capacity to self-renewal, whose tank is filled by the very words of our founding, right? I mean, that is where Abraham Lincoln went. That is where Frederick Douglass went. That is where Martin Luther King went. That is where the suffragettes went. This is where they go. And yet there's this pseudo-sophisticated intellectual attempt to take away that base as you laid it out, right? And to set that clock back some 150, 160 years earlier, which deprives us of a founding based on, in the words of 1776, equality and liberty, which gives us the redounding ability to self-renew, to one that is a story of unfreedom. And the kids are polluted with this nonsense. The kids are polluted with this nonsense to the degree they're educated at all. And if they're not educated at all, I don't know if that's better or worse, but that is what you are seeing in the streets of Kenosha, Portland, Minneapolis, Seattle. You know, I'm hearing chants, I'm seeing chants in the news from these kids yelling, believe it or not, death to America, as if this is Beirut or Ramallah.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I think you mentioned King before, and I think what made him, as well as Frederick Douglass and others, so powerful is even in the midst of really just such tragic treatment that he experienced personally, such terrible, malicious, and obviously resulting in his own murder, the treatment that he experienced, he was still able to call the American founding and specifically the Constitution a promissory note. And in so doing, what he was saying was, as with any promissory note, that the people who wrote it could be trusted, and that the promissory note had within it a promise that could be redeemed. And
I think a check that could be cashed. A check that could be cashed, right?
Right.
Right.
And again, one that could be realized today.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. And sign up for our podcast. Get a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thanks for joining us.